Broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Atlanta, Georgia, it's time for Midtown Business Radio.
Lee Cantor here with Stone Payton, another episode of Midtown Business Radio. Stone, how you doing today?
I am doing well, man, and getting kind of jazzed for what we're doing this afternoon for GMSDC annual meeting and ribbon cutting. We're doing a remote broadcast, so I put on my best socks, and I'm raring to go, man.
That's right. This is our first ribbon cutting, I think.
It's the first one for me, I could tell you that. But this is going to be a fun segment on Midtown Business Radio today. A little bit later in the program, we are going to catch up with Rob Kiszczuk, CEO with Perfect Post. But first up on Midtown Business Radio this morning, it is my distinct pleasure to introduce the president and CEO with the College Football Hall of Fame. Please join me in welcoming to the broadcast Mr. John Stevenson. How you doing, man?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me.
Well, we are delighted to have you. Let's start right out of the box. Mission, purpose. Tell us a little bit about the organization and what you're trying to accomplish.
Sure. In 2009, Atlanta had the opportunity to be a candidate for the move of the National College Football Hall of Fame from South Bend, Indiana, where it had been for the past 25 years before that. Before that, it had been in Kingsland, Ohio, and before that, New York City. The National Football Foundation started the College Football Hall of Fame back in the 40s, and they continued to name the classes, and they're looking for a bigger stage than South Bend. South Bend's a lovely place, but it's harder to get to than Atlanta, certainly. And they were looking for, like I said, a big stage for their mission and for the College Football Hall of Fame. So we in Atlanta, some organizers retained me as their counsel to help negotiate that here. In 2009, we got them to commit to coming here, and now we've got a big building downtown on the old green lot of the Congress Center that should be open for football season this year.
So now when they're deciding where to put it, obviously there was some logic in putting it in South Bend because of Notre Dame mm-hmm. and the popularity of football there. When you're trying to convince them to come to Atlanta, how are you selling that?
Well, Atlanta is a destination city, whether we Atlantans are too close to it to realize what some of us are. I mean, we had over 40 million visitors in 2012, according to the ACVB. The Centennial Park, Georgia World Congress Center, Georgia Dome District is really a destination for tourism and business travel. Ever since the Olympics came and the park was created, of course, we've had the world's largest aquarium built down there in the world of Coca-Cola and Children's Museum, their CNN Center, and now we have that Ferris wheel down there that adds to the ambiance, which is fun. And it really is. I mean, go next week to the SEC Championship basketball tournament, and you'll see that it's a really fun place to be down there. And so to be able to fill in one of the last blank spots down there, which was the old green parking lot of the mm-hmm. Congress Center, us along with the new National Center for Civil and Human Rights, it's also under construction down there. You've got a really cool visitor destination district. Now, from a football perspective, of course, here in the Southeast, football is king, particularly college football.
Right.
We love our football down here. This is a state where we watch high school football on Friday night on TV. And so football, passion for football is at a fever pitch here in the Southeast. But Atlanta is, as we know, kind of this jewel in the Southeast, a very cosmopolitan international city with a great geographic diversity. And people are here from everywhere. That's what has made Atlanta great. You know, when I tell people I'm born and raised in Atlanta, they kind of look at me funny like they've never seen
somebody.
Nobody's from Atlanta.
Yeah, everybody's actually born here, right? Well, there's plenty of us here, but there's plenty of other people here too. That's why Atlanta is what it is. And so you've got this perfect combination. If you're going to build a stage for college football, we love our football down here, but it's not a Southeastern conference or an ACC thing either. This is everybody's place. It's easy to get to Atlanta. We have the world's biggest airport. We're a two-hour flight from 80% of the country's population. And people are coming here already. Again, 40 million visitors in 2012. And the New York Times had an article earlier this year called the 52 places to visit in 2014. This is 52 places in the world mm-hmm. to visit in 2014. And there were eight U.S. locations on that list, and one of them was downtown Atlanta. Not just Atlanta, but specifically downtown Atlanta, because of what's going on down there.
Now, do you see that Hall of Fames and museums have to evolve with the attention span of the visitor nowadays? You have to have more stuff going on in there than maybe you did 10, 20 years ago?
Yeah, you don't have to, but if you want to have a sustainable business model, exactly. Then yes, you do have to. And I don't say that flippantly. Some pure museums know that they need to be endowed and have their annual campaigns to operate, and that's fine. What we wanted to do down on this particular piece of property, given the subject matter we have, was really give it a go at creating a self-sustaining business. We are a nonprofit, but we're not non-making money.
Right.
We have a nonprofit model in that we don't have shareholders. Nobody's making money off of this. All the cash flow that we do generate goes back into the building to keep it fresh, to keep it new every year. So
what are you going to find there?
So what you'll find there is really an attraction. It's an attraction first, with the Hall of Fame as its anchor exhibit. So the Hall of Fame room, the dedicated room that is the Hall of Fame, where the Hall of Famers are on display, is clearly the nicest room in the building. It's kind of like the inner sanctum, but it's 5,000 square feet of a 90,000 square foot building. So the other parts of the building are really an attraction themed around college football. We have a 45-yard long field in the middle of the building. You know, we have a whole gallery dedicated to bands and cheerleaders and mascots and fight songs and
tailgating. So it's a whole college football experience, not just football,
the game. You got it. And it's a whole college football experience. Our visitors are going to be immersed in a celebration of the sport, and they get to see the Hall of Fame as well.
So you can teach them how to paint faces and things like that.
Funny you should mention that. We do have a face painting interactive nice. In there. So on that hallway I talked about, that first gallery was just sort of everything outside the stadium. We have an interactive for kids, but I'm sure big kids will use it too, where you stand in front of the screen, it takes a photo of your face, and then you get to paint it with your, you know, virtually
so you
with your finger.
Whatever.
Oh, yeah. You know, colors, logos, whatever, and then you can, of course, save that to your ticket. So just to touch on that real quick, all of our tickets will be enabled with an RFID chip. We're not over-teching this building, because if you over-tech it, you're out of date the day you open. But we are using it wisely, we think, in that when you do things like that in our building, or you go do you do the radio call booth, right? Or you do fight song karaoke, which mm-hmm. we also have, or you know the game day desk set up. But you can collect these things later from our website because your ticket remembers that you did them. The other thing that the RFID-enabled ticket lets us do is, if you choose to register with us and tell us who your school is, who you cheer for, then there are 14 different opportunities in the building where you will get school-specific things shared with you first, whereas the person next to you that's from another place in the country or from another school will get his or her school shared with him or her first. So we're tailoring the experience to you through your school, because college football fans are fans
of
their school first.
Right. It's a personal
thing.
Yeah,
and particularly in college football, it doesn't really matter, frankly, who's in the uniforms. You're cheering for your school. We're all of our favorite players and our favorite coaches, but first and foremost, you're showing up to cheer for whoever. Georgia, Ohio State, Georgia Tech, whatever. And so that's the design of the building. The very first thing you get to do, you walk in our lobby, and there's a wall of every helmet of every school that plays college football across all divisions. Care to guess how many helmets that is?
That's got to be a lot.
It's over 750 helmets.
Yeah. Wow.
And so this is a very striking feature, because physically you're seeing all these helmets up there. And you get the point. This is everybody's place. This is a big deal. This is not just a Georgia or a Southeast
thing.
Right,
it's not Southeastern Conference
right.
only.
And when you check in, and there are kiosks there where you can check in with us and enable your tag. And if you do it in the lobby there, you tell us you're a Michigan fan. Well, as soon as you do that, the Michigan helmet lights up on the wall and tells everybody the Michigan fan just walked in. So even something as simple as that, we're getting your skin in the game. You're interacting with the building right off the bat through your passion for your school.
Now, you mentioned this ticket. Now, is that that's going to follow me around as I go and explore?
It is.
But is it something that I can virtually take home with me? Is there
Absolutely.
Some of these memories that are going to be able to, like that picture, is that going to go onto like kind of a personalized page, which when I get home I can share it
exactly
on my social media?
Exactly what happens. So whether you register with us or not, you still have a number. Even if you don't tell us your personal information, that
right.
you still have a number. And so you can go to our website after you leave, or frankly while you're there, if you want to do it on your mobile device, and go collect the things that you did in the building. And they'll stay up there for, you know, a certain period of time, and hopefully you go get them and download them and share them.
So with all of this cool stuff to see and do, is this going to be like an events venue as well?
It is. And given the site that we have, the location we're in,
yeah.
We built this to be as much an event venue as we can. Now, unlike the Georgia Aquarium, which has that beautiful ballroom, the Ocean's Ballroom, which is a dedicated event space, mm-hmm. we don't have dedicated event space. We had some, we had limited square footage. We wanted to maximize the visitor experience in the museum. I mean, matched up with all the interactives, we have over 500, museum pieces of memorabilia behind glass too. It's not all virtual, certainly. But so our event space is our exhibit space. So that limits us a little bit. But the field, for instance, that 45-yard long field I told mm-hmm. you about, is in the middle of the building. It's a nice three-story atrium, big 36-foot video board hanging off the wall. That's a really nice banquet and event space. The lobby itself with that big helmet wall is, again, a big three-story exposure. There's also a 150-seat theater on the second floor.
And what's playing in there?
What's playing in there is a film that we are having originally shot and produced. You've heard of a 4K television, maybe, or a super mm-hmm. ultra high definition television. Sure. That's the new generation of HD. Has anybody seen one?
No, I haven't.
Remember the first time you saw an HD TV and you thought your life had changed? Yeah. Well, it's going to be like that again. It's that much higher resolution. And they're very expensive right now, so not many people are shooting in 4K. So, the networks are not shooting in it because the consumers don't have the TVs yet. We've been shooting in 4K. Our production team has been shooting in 4K for the last 3 years at 20 different football games. So we probably have the most 4K footage of anybody right now, and we're going to probably about 90 hours of it, and we're going to boil that all down into a 10-minute film that'll blow your mind. So that's going to be really cool. But it's also in a rentable event space. In other words, it's a projection theater. It's got the 4K capability. It's a 40-foot long by 10-foot tall screen. But, you could have a game-watching party in there for your alumni club, or watch a movie in there, or do a presentation in there. So it's geared to be that for our guests after hours as well. And then the Hall of Fame itself. If you've seen a rendering of our building, you'll notice a large window that's cut into that rotunda feature that looks out over the park. That window looks into that Hall of Fame room I told you about. And the way we're presenting the Hall of Famers is a bit different also. There's almost 1,000 people in the College Football Hall of Fame.
Wow.
Even that's a very, very small percentage of the over 5 million people that have played it. There's a lot of people that play college football. So it's like,
If there's 700 helmets.
Oh, yeah. Exactly. So it's a challenge. Even if they let in 12 or 15 a year, it's still not everybody right. that probably, what you'd think might be in there. But it presented us a challenge in that you've got, over 1,000 plaques that they had in South Bend, and where do you put those and how do you display those? And so we decided not to. We're doing it totally differently in that our presentation of the Hall of Famers in that room, it's a nice big round room. Again, stone on the floor, wood on the walls, two-story, big cathedral-type feel in there, with that window looking out over the park. And so around the room, you'll have these big, thick glass blades that jut out from the wall around the room, pointing inward. And we're going to etch the Hall of Famers into those, their names and their school, the position and the year they played, into those glass panels by class. So that'll be the physical enshrinement, if you will, of those Hall of Famers, just their name etched very deeply and nicely into this big piece of glass. Mm-hmm. In the middle of the room, we have 10 viewers, that we call them, which are essentially 55-inch touchscreens in a portrait orientation. And you come up to these screens, and you can look up Hall of Famers with three touches by their name, their school, the position they played. Of course, if you've enabled your tag and you're a USC fan and you just approach one of these, it will welcome you and offer you the USC Hall of Famers.
Oh, so
first.
It defaults to whatever you're...
Yes, and if you're not registered, it just lets you search.
Right.
But you can pull up a Hall of Famer and see whatever content we can find and curate and put into this machine.
So, for the older people, maybe it's just their picture or stats or something like that?
Yeah, somebody from the 1800s, we might have one picture of them. Right. I think we have at least five five photographs. But even if you're just looking at a photograph on this screen, we think it's still a more engaging presentation of the Hall of Famers than a piece of plaster that kind of looks like the guy.
Right.
And then you can certainly... you pull up the picture and you can swipe either way to look at bios or media. And even if that guy's not around, maybe we can get a hold of his grandchildren or his children and interview them. And you tell us about, your father's college football experience. What do you remember about it? So you still can preserve that oral history. in these screens. And again, we're not over technology, not too heavy on technology from a hardware perspective. It's just a screen. The content, though, becomes the star of the show, and you can interact with this content.
And it seems like the content can keep growing.
Exactly. You can add stuff every year. So if you've registered with us and you're a Notre Dame fan, well, the next time we have a Notre Dame Hall of Famer in there, we'll send you an email and say you got to come see Notre Dame. Or if we add something to a current Notre Dame Hall of Famer that we didn't have before, we can say, come back and look at this.
Mm-hmm.
This is not a bucket list Hall of Fame. This is not where you pack up and go see it
one time, and I've
checked the box.
Always,
you know?
this is changing and evolving.
It's going to be different every time you come in.
So those are permanent things. So is there going to be ever changing kind of refreshed temporary exhibits as well?
We have a temporary exhibit space, which we took this as a cue from the aquarium, which has a nice temporary changing gallery, and also, frankly, places like the High Museum, where they have new things in every 6 or 9 or 12 months.
Mm-hmm.
We'd like to be able to do that in here too. So we have about 1,500 square feet of unassigned space. On day one, there won't be anything in there, but this is a place where you can have changing exhibits that are relevant to football. But you can be as creative as you want. I mean, you can highlight a team or a, you know, running backs or a conference, or even put artwork in there.
Right. What about when events happen here, like sometimes the SEC championship is here? Would you have like SEC centric things during those times of year?
Yes. I mean, every screen in there, the video board, the theater, even the viewers, you know, can be changed on the drop of a hat. Mm-hmm. I mean, we probably won't switch the exhibitry up too much. If you had somebody, now if you had a school come in there, like an alumni association or an athletic department come in and rent out the building as for their event, then you could really, you know,
right,
change it up there. What's more likely is that we'll, the bigger challenge is to, if we have collection that is not on the floor. So we're using about a third of the collection of the artifacts on day one. But if there's collection that's back in our archive that's relevant to that team, we'd want to have some kind of temporary exhibit out on the floor,
right,
in the lobby, something that shows some more of that.
Right.
School
so, if
stuff.
like University of Alabama came here, yep, their alumni association was having a dinner or gala, mm-hmm, or something. Mm-hmm. You can come and bring out all the Alabama stuff,
correct,
and sprinkle it around to kind, yep, of customize it for them.
Right. And if they're renting out the field as their main, which most people are renting out the field for their buffet and,
right,
eat dining area and their whatever stage they're going to have, you know, we could put out some collection that's not on the floor that's relevant to that school. And then also in our retail store, another important revenue stream for us is our retail store, our souvenir shop. We've stretched the souvenir shop all along Marietta Street on the first floor between Stats, the sports bar down there, and the Omni Hotel. This enables us to allow...
So that's kind of the window as you're walking down the street?
Correct.
That's what you're saying?
That's right.
And the enshrining ceremony, is this going to take place here every year now going forward? Is that
that's right,
how that's going to work?
Yep. The National Football Foundation has a big dinner gala every year at the Waldorf Ballroom in New York City. That's not going to change. They've been doing that for, you know,
right,
for 70 years or something like that. They do a lot of things at that dinner, not just Hall of Fame. They acknowledge the Hall of Famers there, but they also, mm-hmm, name their scholar-athlete class, give away the Campbell Trophy, do a bunch of things there. And traditionally, in South Bend, they've had a separate enshrinement ceremony, as they call it, which is a more public event for the fans. And so we will continue to do that in Atlanta. 2014 is an outlier. We're all resources dedicated to opening the building here.
Sure.
We may do something later in the fall, but 2015 is when we'll settle into what our ordinary schedule is for events like that. And there'll be other events, not just that. We want to do some around the SEC Championship game, Chick-fil-A kickoff game, Chick-fil-A Bowl, which is now in the new... the new BCS, the new college football playoff. Certainly, we'll have a lot of events around those.
Now, so I want to hear more about your backstory. You mentioned a little bit, but how did you land here, man? Paint that career path for us.
When you were a little kid, you're like, one day I'm going to be in charge of the College,
yes,
Football Hall of Fame.
That's been my goal since I was an 8-year-old.
That or a cowboy.
Exactly, right. Firefighter. Mm-hmm. No, I was just, you know, right place at the right time, I suppose. I was a partner at Troutman Sanders, a law firm in here in town, doing corporate work, contract work, mergers and acquisitions, and private equity. I started representing the Chick-fil-A Bowl as a pro bono client in 2005, and so I was doing all of their transactions with their title sponsor and their other sponsors, the conferences, for pick selection slots and with ESPN for their TV. So I kind of had this college football niche, you know, as part of a small part of my practice. So when this opportunity came to Atlanta, it emerged from the bowl. Gary Stokin, who runs the Chick-fil-A Bowl, this was, you know, this is his vision originally. Mm-hmm. Him and Steve Hatchell at the National Football Foundation. So since I was working with Gary on that, he looped me in as the lawyer on that deal from day one. And eventually he got it to the point where it was time for it to kind of live on its own. And when that point came, they asked me to take the reins here, because I'd kind of been on the deal since day one and knew all the people involved. And, right. You know, Gary had a big job to do with the bowl and get us into this playoff system, which he did. And so they were looking around and they tapped me. So here I am.
Now, have you gotten good support for sponsors and the local business community here?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. If you were to look around and say at our biggest sponsors now, you've got Coca-Cola, AT&T, Chick-fil-A, Kia. And then on down there from there you have Home Depot and Under Armour and some others. And if you looked at those sponsors I just named, particularly our largest ones, you've probably got some of the largest buyers of college football inventory on ESPN and other networks. They're big into college football as mm-hmm. from a marketing standpoint. So, and they're all Atlanta. Some are Atlanta-based companies, sure. And with AT&T and Kia, very Atlanta-heavy, if not Atlanta-based. And so we're lucky to have those companies in town that are great corporate statesmen, which is a tradition here in Atlanta. And they're already into college football big time. Regions Bank, Southwest Airlines, these mm-hmm. companies, you can't watch a college football game without seeing them.
Sure.
So the fact that this is coming here and they have such a presence here made it a natural fit to where once it was – once we were getting towards, really having this thing fully spec'd out and designed the right way and getting ready to break ground, they were all on board, very enthusiastic.
Now, how did you integrate the sponsors within the hall?
Yeah, when you do this through private enterprise and you use sponsors to build the building, you definitely want them to have their presence in the building so that the visitors know who delivered this to them. So you got to have some corporate presence in there. You don't want to appear too right. in your face with the logos.
It's got to be elegant.
Has to be. You want to maintain that museum quality, and all our sponsors are understand that better than anybody else, frankly. So, kind of like I'll bring up the Georgia Aquarium as another example. You go in there and you go into a mm-hmm. particular feature, and it's presented by right. Home Depot or whoever else. It's kind of like that. We're going to have, as you enter into different galleries, they'll be presented by certain sponsors. It'll be a nice brushed stainless steel, indicator mm-hmm. with their logo on it. No color. And then as you go around within the galleries, I'll use Under Armour, for example. Within the Kia Performance Gallery, as we call it, you've got lots of features, one of which is the history of the uniform exhibit, where you go from the old leather helmets and sweaters all the way up to the modern uniform. Well, that is presented by Under Armour, which makes sense because sure. they're the apparel. So we try to work them in where they make sense. You know, you go to our tailgating exhibit, you're going to see two full-size Kia automobiles there decked out for tailgating.
And there might be a Coca-Cola.
You might see a Coca-Cola. You might see somebody drinking a Coke when you're walking through the Coke gallery.
Right.
But, Coca-Cola, they're all about happiness, right? They're the happiest machine. And so they love being in that gallery that is talking about traditions and mascots and cheerleaders and bands. You know, AT&T has the gallery that talks about great rivalries and radio calls and highlights. And, Chick-fil-A, they're almost exclusively college football with their sports marketing. It's right in their demo. They love the message. They love the amateur aspect of it. They love the leadership and scholarship lessons that can be taught with amateur football. And so they're all in on that aspect of it and why we love college football.
The economic impact of this has got to be tremendous. It must have city leaders and citizens that know what's going on very excited about this. Any rough projections about the kind of attendance and impact that we
sure.
can expect?
Oh, yeah. And projecting attendance is the most important thing you can do when you undertake something like this.
Yeah.
Particularly when you're doing it through a private enterprise like we are. It's just like any other real estate development project. Can you lease this thing up, right? It's you treat it like a real estate development project first and foremost. And so you get your experts around the table, and we had two or three studies done independently and had them done again in 2012 on how many people do we think will come here, because that everything kind of most everything drives off of that number, what your revenue will be. And so that dictates, at the end of the day, what you can build and how much you can spend on it, what your expense model can be. So you don't want to be wrong about that number. It's pro forma. It's all a guess, but you try to stay conservative. So long answer to your question, but our projections for year four, which is the important year, because year one, two, and three, we're going to have a ton of people come, and then we'll drop off and level off to what we really are. You know, your first 2 years are an outlier. No, we'll never have as many people come to our building as we do in the first 2 years, and then you settle into what you really are. So what's that number? And that number for us is 500,000 visitors, 500,000 people.
Wow.
Which is a lot. But when you look around the neighborhood there, you've got the aquarium doing well north of $2 million a year. The World of Coca-Cola doing just around $1 million a year. On the other side of the spectrum, you have the CNN Center Studio Tour doing about 300, 320. And the Children's Museum about 200, 210,000. So when you think about, we're about the same size building and probably around the same ticket price as the World of Coca-Cola. So if we can do about half as many as they do, then we'll be okay.
Now, do you think this is going to be a destination where people are going to build their trip around your facility? Or is it they're coming to Atlanta, or maybe they're going to the aquarium and you're just hoping to grab a half a day or a day off of that person?
Yeah, both. I mean, the other good thing about our Hall of Fame that is different from other Halls of Fame, NASCAR, pro football, pro baseball, basketball, is that we're right next to our football venue.
Right. There's how many big football games that take place downtown?
I mean, and you know,
you have NFL and
it's everything. So just the college, you've got the Chick-fil-A kickoff game, which there are two of this year.
Right.
You have Georgia State football playing in there. You have the SEC championship game. You have the Chick-fil-A Bowl, which now is a new BCS game. Mm-hmm. You've got the Bank of America Historically Black College Football Classic. You have high school playoff games. And then, oh, by the way, you have the Atlanta Falcons. And those are football fans, too. It doesn't, right. I mean, college, pro, doesn't matter.
And
it's
plus
football.
You have NBA people that are coming
exactly.
there.
You got, you know, and college basketball. And don't forget, 10 blocks up the road, we have Georgia Tech.
Right.
So there's lots of people coming to downtown Atlanta.
Right. That might have an interest in sports.
Well, specifically for a college football weekend. So mm-hmm. we hope that those college football fans that are coming in town will craft their visit around our facility, because it's a college football thing. Now, they'll go to everybody else, too. We're hoping that people will come in and stay for two
or
3 days
at a time.
Right,
it's an and, not an or.
That's right. That's right. Now, but you do also have visitors coming here specifically to experience Atlanta's offerings of the aquarium, Coca-Cola, civil rights. I mean, all these things that Atlanta is known for as a tourist destination. And don't forget the 3 million conventioneers that are in the Georgia World Congress Center every year for conventions.
Yeah, so you should be able to get to your 500,000, that seems.
We hope so.
Where can our listeners go to learn more?
Our website is cfbhall.com, as in College Football Hall. We've got some renderings there. We have a nice fly-through video there. We have a webcam there. If it's appropriate to say here, you can buy some bricks there. We're doing the bricks just like everybody else.
Too?
Absolutely.
Right. And there's still room for sponsors?
Absolutely.
Businesses want to
absolutely.
Get involved?
Absolutely. We've got we got plenty of categories open. We have lots of different price points. We want businesses that are either already in college football and need this as an authenticator, or frankly, a lot of companies are interested in dipping their toe into the college football demographic. It's expensive to buy airtime on ESPN right during college football, but here's a way you can kind of get in at the top, if you will, and have college football fans coming in here as your audience. And it's not just going to be the bricks and mortar. I mean, this is a national play. The National Football Foundation has 121 chapters around 47 states, like the Touchdown Club of Atlanta, that focus on local, high schoolers. And so you've got this huge broad base and all these stakeholders in college football that if we do this right, this will be part of that patchwork. We're going to broadcast from here. We're going to have shows done from here. Mm-hmm. You'll get used to seeing this facility a lot, and so our sponsors hopefully will benefit from that.
Well, it has been an absolute delight having you in the studio this morning, and I hope you'll come back. Maybe get us caught
anytime
up right before the ribbon cutting, because we'll be ribbon cutting pros by then.
That's right. Experience in that.
Hey, how about hanging out with us while we visit
our next
guest?
Absolutely. Thank you.
Yes, sir. All right. Next up on Midtown Business Radio, we welcome back to the studio, no stranger to the Business Radio X microphone, CEO and founder with Perfect Post, Mr. Rob Kiss Chuck. How you doing, man?
I'm doing great. Good to be here. Thanks for having me back around.
Yeah. So you getting fired up about this college football thing?
Yeah. I can't wait. I saw the old one, and I can't wait for the new one here right in our backyard.
Well, our listeners can't see it, but Rob's pretty sizable guy. I didn't know if you were captain of the chess team or maybe had a little football experience in your day.
You know, I played high school, and I walked on briefly at Georgia Tech, but Georgia Tech's not an easy school. And when you're there trying to keep a 3-2, there's not in electrical engineering, computer engineering, there's not a lot of time for football. It was 16 hours a week in the off season, so I had to kind of let it slide by the wayside.
So get us caught up on Perfect Post. What's going on over there, man?
Sure. So you may not recognize that name. Perfect Post is a new name as of January 1. We used to be known as Badgie. We got a slick new website at perfectpost.net, upgraded the domain, a better focus on the product. We have a better idea of who we are and who we're helping now. And so that helped us kind of choose a new brand that when we call someone up on the phone or drop them an email or they just come to our website, gives them an immediate idea what they're getting themselves into, what we do and how we're there to help.
Now, can you refresh our listeners who maybe aren't familiar with where you've been, what you guys are up to?
Sure. So, you know, we came out of Georgia Tech's Flashpoint Startup Accelerator a couple years ago. And when we came in, we started off just wanting to – I had been in kids gaming, social gaming, and social networking going back to Sonny Perdue's reelection campaign and Rudy Giuliani's presidential campaign. And so I'd done this stuff in social, done this stuff in kind of game-like things, and I was kind of tinkering with that in the social space. What we focused in on, though, was we found when you really ask someone, you know, what is performance worth to you in social? The people that could give us an answer to that were people who had a dollar attached to what they were doing in social. So We started focusing, and we were working with Half Off Depot, now InCrowd here in town, and some other folks, and we found that they could tell you, if I increase your Facebook reach and clicks by 30%, you can tell me what that's worth. So we've really focused in on how do we help an e-commerce marketer, someone with a dollar sign attached to what they're doing, optimize social media for revenue generation, for email acquisition. How do you convert that fan into an email subscriber or someone else you've got kind of your hands on? And then take the data you get from all that and feed that into your paid social. So you're going to spend some money in Facebook marketing. How do you spend that as effectively as possible?
So now, have you learned any tips or tricks for the people in order to increase engagement that actually does convert to business?
Yeah, and we built all that into product. I mean, we start with data. And we are feeding data back into our system every single week. Facebook's algorithm changes all the time. They don't necessarily tell you how they're changing it. We let the data tell us how it's changing it, how people are engaging differently. And then we feed that right back into our product to say, look, if you post a link post, you're going to get more clicks right now. If you post a photo post right now, you're going to get more engagement. And if you're trying to get a click through to buy a product, then those clicks are important.
Now, what about the new kind of quizzes and surveys and things like that? That seems to be part of this evolution as well.
Well, certainly. There's certainly a bent of it, which is content, you know. So we kind of focus on how do you take, you know, it's up to our clients to provide the best content. How do we wrap that content up in a way that's going to give them the best fighting chance to reach people? Because there's certain ways you can do things that are going to have no chance of succeeding. We want to keep people from doing that. If you write a 10-page essay and try to fit it into one post, you know, 90% of that's going to go below the fold. Nobody's going to see it. If you bury a link 10 layers down, it can be the best content in the world. It's not going to work. We don't focus as much on, you know, I would say kind of the quizzes and some of the, like, misleading headline stuff is a little bit of kind of garbage in gaming the system. We try and shy away from that a little bit because if you focus on gaming the system, you're going to get your comeuppance eventually. They're going to change things. If you build your business on gaming it, you're going to lose.
Well, I mean, you have like BuzzFeed or Upworthy. Yep. I mean, those sites live on that.
Yeah, and Upworthy's traffic is already down a little bit. They've already taken a bit of a hit, and it wouldn't surprise me if the wind changes on that a little bit.
So how does the sales and marketing thing work for you guys? Are you just sought out, or do you use some of these strategies and tactics to go get your clients? Or walk us through that piece of it.
We have been using our own product to
eating your own cooking. Good for you.
I mean, you know, when we're going to post, just like anybody else, we want our content out at the right time, in the right format, with the right optimizations to reach as many people as humanly possible. So last week we turned on a feature that lets you add a little shop now or learn more button to your Facebook posts. And we use it on all of ours and it gets you more clicks. And it's, you know, we want to be adopting those features as soon as possible because our clients have dollars attached to it. So right now, you know, some of it's telling our success stories using our product. Some of it's, you know, good old fashioned picking up the phone or emailing someone who doesn't know you and trying to get their attention. I mean, it is, you know, that work of reaching kind of this mid-market retailer.
Right. So I want to get a little real consulting, if we might, because this is, you know, like our show after
exactly.
all. So let's take us. We're not like an e-commerce business, so that people don't go to the website and give us dollars directly for a service. Mm-hmm. But we profit greatly, and our underwriters really profit greatly, the more that our content is distributed.
Yep.
So we've got Michael's back there. He's probably doing it right now, tweeting and Facebooking and all that okay. stuff. So let's say that... I mean, are we the kind of client you would even entertain working with? And if so, what would that engagement cycle look like? Would you sit down with us and...
Yeah, so imagine, you know, you've got this show, and you knew what was coming right. up on the show, and you knew who was coming on this show. So you have, and I've seen you've done this before, you have several pieces of content associated with this show. You have the, hey, announcing this, it's coming up, and you might want to just put that out at the best time on, let's say, Monday, right? Get it out to the best time in front of the biggest audience, tune in at this time. Then you might schedule... one with us for, you know, 10 o'clock this morning saying, hey, we're live on the air now. We let you schedule it. We tell you what format to do it in. We tell you if it's too long. And then we might, you know, we'll actually advise you on, are you posting too much or too little? So we'll tell you basically how many fans did you gain? How many fans did you lose? Is that churn acceptable to you? Because that's all. Posting frequency it's a question of churn. It's how many people are you losing? There's no right or wrong answer. It's what are you cool with? and some of that's a function of your content too. If you post like, hey, here's our show again, here's our show again, that's not going to play well. But what we can let you do from this show is, you know, take a quote from the College Football Hall of Fame. Take a quote from what we say. Put those next to a picture and post the content. Then post another post that is just, you know, hey, this show is now, you can listen to it now. And so take a few pieces of content, schedule it out. If you want to, let's say, reward your sponsors, right? Part of what we do is we have a real simple promotions engine that lets you run a contest as frequently as every single week or every day if you need to. So you could certainly say, you know, hey, we're giving away a couple tickets to the College Football Hall of Fame. And if you want those, then like us, like Perfect Post, like The Hall, and like, let's say, Home Depot. And we make it real easy to reactivate that audience every single week. You get their email address. And what you get that's really compelling then is you get information on the things that they like. Now, that's interesting on an individual level. But you take a couple hundred people, a couple thousand people, and you aggregate the things that people like. And then you get kind of this core truth you didn't realize, which is our fans like these things. I'll give you an example. Magnolia Pictures. Magnolia Pictures, big film company. They made Blackfish, documentary about SeaWorld. Got a lot of buzz this year, right? And so they were using our platform to promote it. And one of the things that they learned, they've been doing contests with us every week for 6 months now. They have over 10% of their Facebook fans have used their contest to try and win a Blu-ray disc. And so now we know information on 10,000 of their fans. Well, what we can tell you that's the most interesting truth is that their fans are 30 times more likely to like the Criterion Collection on Facebook than your average Facebook fan. So when they want to go out and spend money to acquire more fans, the smartest way for them to spend money is to target fans of Criterion Collection. So you can unearth these truths by gathering this data in aggregate. And so that's really important. When you're selling product, one of the most important things they're looking at is, look, what's it cost me to acquire someone and what's that lifetime value of that customer? So how do I acquire customers that are good customers at the most cost-effective way I can?
So now, is this only Facebook-centric or does it work in other social media channels as well?
Good question. So it's started off Facebook because that's where basically 86% of social commerce has been flowing through Facebook. We have added Twitter support now, and we will continue kind of knocking down the things that make sense. You know, I think Pinterest makes a lot of sense from an analytics perspective. Google Plus requires, there's some gatekeepers on the access side of that. And Instagram's probably the furthest out for us because it's actually nearly impossible to get a clickable link in Instagram other than you can put it on your profile. That's all you got.
So now, is the strategy the same in a Facebook as it is in Twitter, or do you have to adjust the strategy?
The strategy, we have a machine learning algorithm behind everything. So our strategy is throw the inputs into the machine learning algorithm, let us tell us what the truth is from a post timing between posts, formatting perspective. So there's different inputs on the Twitter side. There are different types of posts. Your frequency is different. Your traffic patterns are different. Twitter doesn't surface something from 3 days ago the way Facebook does.
Right.
So your distribution curves are different, but you get to the same you get to the same approach, which is we feed in the data, we tell you what the right thing is for that channel, and it may be a little bit different, but we'll handle it through the same mechanism.
So we've been seeing quite a bit of you from time to time at different events that we do remote broadcast at that had to do with raising venture capital or just getting your story out, and you have fairly recently teamed up with someone who has a pretty good track record for getting companies off the ground. You want to speak to that a little bit?
Yeah, so you know, one of the folks that we are tied up with is Mark Cuban. And people know him from Shark Tank, and people know him from the Dallas Mavericks. Probably more Shark Tank than anything, which is kind of funny.
Yeah.
And people don't know that he actually, you know, started and built a company, and that's where he made his money, was for, by selling it to Yahoo, for broadcast.com to Yahoo for a ton of cash. And so, yeah, I met Mark 2 days before the Super Bowl in Indianapolis, Indiana, a couple years ago.
Huh.
And we had just finished Flashpoint, and we had just finished pitching in Silicon Valley and in New York, and just went to a Shark Tank watching party at Shula's at the Westin in Indianapolis, and we watched Shark Tank. He didn't want to talk to anybody during that, but he talked to some people after that, and he said, I want to keep talking to you. Let's, you know, figure out if there's something here.
And then, so how long did it take from that initial meeting for him to say, you know what, I'm in with you guys. I want to see what you guys can do.
Yeah, you know, it's a process, and so we started talking in early February, and I think we actually finally closed the round in July, and there's, you know, probably about halfway through there, we had a term sheet and we were basically in agreement, and it's just kind of lawyers sifting through the little tiny details and then, you know, due diligence, make sure all the paperwork's in order, and, you know, Uncle John doesn't have, you know, 50% of the company. We forgot to mention that sort of thing.
So what are some do's and don'ts you might share with aspiring entrepreneurs that may be going after capital, with or without the likes of a Mark Cuban, but I suspect maybe you've got a little scar tissue, maybe a few lessons learned going through this process, yeah?
Yeah, you know, I think it's challenging because it takes a lot of your time, but you always have to be kind of finding an increasing truth of what your business is. Like, you have to be increasing the chance that someone will want to fund you at the same time as you're trying to secure the funding. And so you kind of do the stance where
it's
you're working on
the... It's a whole other job, right?
Yeah.
Getting the funding.
I mean, you're working on the product, you're working on building revenue behind the product, and you're working on relationships and conversations, and even, you know, honestly, telling your story better, because you tell the story better, you know, 3 months out than when you first started. And so over time, it goes on and on. You know, I think one of the good things is just to be direct and to do your research. I mean, sometimes people will be like, how can I get in touch with Mark Cuban? I'm like, you can use Google, because his email address is out there for the world, because he likes deal flow, and he's just kind of that guy. And it's one of those things where you want to know who you're talking to. So some people want numbers. Some people want a long explanation. Some people want the briefest thing possible. And that's, you know, what you learn is just to mirror the language of who you're working with. I mean, Mark writes in like half sentences and, you know, some occasional misspellings. I won't intentionally misspell something writing to him, but one of our advisors did say, look, your English is too correct for this investor that you're talking to. And there's other investors who might be exactly the right thing to do. But if someone's less formal and just wants to get to the point, then, you know, not belaboring them with more words than they would write back to you. And I think the other thing I learned was just to kind of keep it more as a kind of a more of a ping pong. If you have five questions to answer, maybe don't go for all of them at once. Maybe go for one or two and get the response, and then just keep it more of as an engaging dialogue. Not to play a game, but just to, I mean, you know, when you get an email with 10 questions in it, you're like,
yeah,
I'm going to do that later. I'm
right.
not doing that.
Never
right
do
now.
It. Right. Now, is it something, obviously, one of the benefits of working with him is, yeah, you got some money. But has that opened up doors for you? Were you been able to leverage the relationships that he has?
Absolutely. So, I mean, when we were first discussing whether to do the investment even, it largely centered around Landmark Theaters. He owns Landmark Theaters. There's Landmark Midtown Arts Cinema over here off Piedmont. That's his. And part of the process was talking to their marketing team about how would you work with Landmark Theaters to help them. And so that was even part of the original funding decision. And so since then, we're very actively working with the Dallas Mavericks. There's a very clear, you know, they are in the e-commerce business, whether or not it seems obvious. They are very much in the business of, they have an expiring inventory every day or every week, and they need to sell tickets.
Right.
And all of that blocking and tackling. So some things, the best time to post "we win a game" is when you win the game. Right? That, you know, at 10 o'clock when you win the game, that's the best time to post that. But the best time to post a sponsor message, they have sponsors to feed just like everybody else. The best time to post a recap of the game, that's all different priority for them. We've had a great opportunity. You know, Magnolia Pictures and Magnet Releasing are both also in his wheelhouse. And so those have been, you know, he doesn't force us on anybody. He just kind of opens up the door and says, you know, he gets us that first conversation of, you know, here's Rob, here's Perfect Post. You guys should talk.
That's always the hardest one to get. That first conversation, that's the hard one. I mean, anybody in sales and marketing knows that. Yeah. So that's great.
So now you were kind enough to share some free advice for us at Business Radio X. Do you have any advice for John at the College Football Hall of Fame? A way to leverage social media? Because he's going to spend, you know, in a couple years, he's going to need to get some more people in there. The first two, he says, he got covered.
Wow. Yeah, I mean, a lot of the things he was just talking about, one of the advantages they have, just as in the physical space, they have, you know, 2/3 of their collection is in archive.
Right.
You know, they have a preponderance of content.
Right.
And I think, you know, one of the interesting opportunities to test out coming up is you can actually target content on Facebook by school.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, right now, I don't know how many fans the Hall has right now. Probably some...
couple thousand, yeah.
Yeah. And so as the, you know, as right now, you're talking to an audience of 2,000. You don't want to over-optimize for it. And there's a lot to talk about. You can talk about what you're building. And you have a ton of content around that. And I think that'll excite people. I think kind of just keeping that steady flow of content is the thing, probably the biggest thing people do wrong. And the single biggest missed opportunity I see is actually posting on weekends.
Mm-hmm.
People don't post on weekends. People post when they're at work. They don't schedule something in advance. And so if you think about it, you're competing for this audience. You're competing in the newsfeed for, you know, people have, I think Facebook says they have 5 times as much content as they can show any given person. So they're only showing you 20% of the things that you could see.
Huh.
But that competition is lower on weekends. On weekends, when everyone else isn't posting from their brand page, that's a good time to be able to post.
And that would dovetail nicely into him because that's when the games are.
Absolutely, yeah. People are probably sitting somewhere with a second screen device.
Yeah.
You know, and I would also look at how do you, and you've talked about this from when you're in the museum, right? When you're in the museum, that gives you an opportunity to have a relationship with someone to tell them when there's new content down the line.
Right.
Similarly, on the social side, I mean, you need to kind of have those hooks to convert a fan into an email address, into mm-hmm. knowing their school affinity, and those kind of opportunities to move. You know, it's just a pipeline that you move people through, and some people won't want to do it, but a lot of people will, and you can delight them in the process.
Right.
And the Hall would seem like there's lots of opportunity to share, especially photos, which play nicely in.
Yes.
Social media channel.
Mm-hmm.
Yep, absolutely.
So what's next for you guys?
So, you know, what's next for us is really, you know, we worked with a lot of people on the product and trying to get the product right.
Yeah.
And I'm not a perfectionist on that. But even feeling like it was really worth making a concerted effort to start selling, we got to that point in November. And so we are in this process of having gone from essentially no paying customers in November. And we're adding them, you know, every week or so, and it's picking up steam. The pipeline's picking up. And so it's really learning how to serve those customers well. We have, you know, almost a consultative call every couple weeks with our customers. It's just as much for us as it is for them, right? It's here's what we're seeing, and here's what could work well. And it's also them saying, look, here's what we're seeing, and here's what could work better with what you're doing. It's been like oxygen for us. It's been fantastic feedback. So,
Now, is the service at a point right now where a customer can go online and just create this self-service, do it on their own kind of environment, or is it something where one of your people is going to call them and kind of help them walk them through the best ways to optimize the service to their needs?
Right now, when we start working with someone, we do an initial kickoff call, and then they're good. It's completely self-service after that, although they're welcome to call us. So there is a little bit of hand-holding up front just to part of it is, you know, we don't have – when your price points and, you know, ranging anywhere up to $1,500 a month, we're not having an online checkout for $1,500 a month.
Right.
So there's, you know, that whole kind of, we're dealing with a slightly more sophisticated marketer than, let's say, you know, a $10 a month social tool.
Right.
So we do have that relationship that we build with people where we set up the biweekly calls and that sort of thing. But after that, it's completely whatever they want to do. They don't have to talk to us unless they want to.
And then the customer is the sweet spot for you is an e-commerce of some kind or not necessarily?
Yeah, I mean, fundamentally, it's someone who knows what the value is from social media. Someone who, you know, we were talking to someone who even is in e-commerce. And I asked him, look, if we could get you 30% more of any other number, if whether it's clicks, whether it's engagement, whether it's reach, what is that worth to you? And they said, we don't know. And for someone who says we don't know, that's hard for us, because how do you price a product? Our product is now worth we don't know.
Right.
So
it's a multiple of we don't know.
Yeah. We'll take a 30% premium on we don't know. That's what the price is. So it's someone who knows the value. So, you know, they at least know 30% more of X would be worth, you know, Y dollars to us. And so that has centered heavily in e-commerce, particularly in kind of repeat purchase categories. So health and beauty, consumer electronics, apparel are all real sweet spots. You know, if you're selling clothing, it does have an expiration date. It's very easy to have a lot to talk about. And people don't really mind seeing different, you know, we have a client that's in children's clothing. Seeing cute kids and cute outfits in your newsfeed, and every once in a while you want to buy it, that's pretty easy to like.
So can I ask a question?
Yeah.
But if they don't know what the value of it is, do you have enough metrics or do you have enough research and data to tell them what the value is depending on their industry, or at least ballpark it?
So if someone at least knows what they're paying for a click through other channels, we can benchmark against that. We can tell you how many clicks they're getting, what the lift has been on the clicks, and compare that through. One of the next things we've got coming is integrations into different commerce platforms. So integration into Magento and Shopify and BigCommerce and folks like that, so that we can know when something that somebody clicked on in Facebook actually leads to a transaction and pull all that reporting all the way back into our product.
Yeah, because our business is not an it's not an e-commerce business. I mean, we first and foremost, our business model is getting people to physically walk themselves through our door and pay us a ticket and come see a show that we put on inside our building,
yep,
bricks and mortar. So we're starting to talk about how we start really marketing this, which we'll start, you know, in the spring, mm-hmm, when we get closer to opening. And I'm just curious about how the social engagement will translate into people coming to visit us.
Right. Yep. Yeah. Is there a way to say they like, you know, X number of likes equal X number of dollars in John's case?
You know, that's interesting, because it really depends even on how you have cultivated your audience, right? At 2,000 fans, it seems like you've probably cultivated a fairly authentic audience.
Well,
and that's an important starting point.
Those are largely inherited. I mean,
those are fans from South Penn, Indiana.
So we've actually left. We took over the handles. And we can just let them sit there. We're doing little stuff, but we're kind of letting the system cleanse a little bit so that we can start with our own fresh coming out with. So we have that good base to start with. But the effort for us is to get more people that are fans, and then how do we communicate? What do we say to get them to plan their visit around our attraction when they come here?
What we find is that someone who's going to work with us, they're looking at how to kind of generate revenue from social. They're already thinking about how to do that through paid and organic search. They're already trying to think about how to do that through display advertising. And so they have the conversion tracking systems already built into their website to capture those other things. And we can piggyback right on top of that. I mean, they can attribute the revenue from us just like they can attribute it from Google AdWords.
Yeah. And we will be saying selling tickets online. I mean, just like when the aquarium opened, we want people to make a reservation to come in here. We can manage flows.
Right. So. And also, there's like you mentioned, there's a whole gift shop experience.
Exactly.
They could be buying things year-round whether they're there or not.
Yep.
Well, before we wrap, let's make sure that our listeners have coordinates. Where can they go to learn more and have a substantive conversation like you guys have started here about these topics?
But that's what the conversation looks like, right? When they contact you, those are the questions you're asking, and that's the information that the potential customer would need to be able to share, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. So our website's at perfectpost.net, and I emailed me directly at rob@perfectpost.net, and probably hunt us down on Twitter and Facebook as well.
All right. Well, thank you so much for being part of the show today.
All right. Thank you.
This is Lee Cantor for Stone Payton. We will see you all next week on Midtown Business Radio.